It is time for David Tarachuk with the Media Beat. David joins us on a Friday morning. He has his own website, which is a fantastic website, themediabeat.us. David's also a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief, and we get together with him once a week. Good morning, David.
It's good to be reporting in again from the media capital of the world, New York City, and I'm glad to be joining the sharp-eyed Marshall Miles once again. So, where do we start? Well, September has historically been the peak of the American hurricane season, I guess,
yep.
And here we are on the very last day of the month with a big one. The News Press newspaper of Fort Myers covers Lee County, possibly the hardest hit so far of Florida's southwest counties. It's now assessing the effect of Hurricane Ian, making its deadly landfall. Not many deaths yet so far. Cross fingers. It's not as fatal as it might have been. The News Press embraces communities like Bonita Beach, that is, and Naples, too. Of course, their own working, like any journalist in the region, their own working operations have been badly hampered by the extreme conditions, but they're still a good on-the-ground source for how things are going everywhere around. And that needs to be considered carefully, we, the readers, can even get to their website. Of course, communications are notoriously affected by hurricanes. Towers get knocked down, the power outages affected. So inevitably, and I guess we do see this every time, local radio really comes into its own in real time. During severe events like these. Let me single out some local stations that are working really hard right now. There's Sunny Radio at 106.3 FM. That's a good Florida name for a station in different kinds of weather than this, I suppose. But Sunny Radio's there. 96 Croc at 96.1 FM. And of course, when they... totally refreshed and stronger Hurricane Ian swings in again from the Atlantic this time, and it hits Georgia and the Carolinas. The local stations there will come into their own. I don't want to put aside entirely local TV stations. They're responding to the power outages and the like by turning to their YouTube channel streams to get through. And, of course, social media gets employed by many broadcasters and official agencies, too, at times like this. But always we find that it's local radio that people must turn to. And let me quote someone who really knows what he's talking about, Craig Fugate, who's a kind of dean of emergency management in the region, a former director of Florida's state emergency agency, and he led the national FEMA in President Obama's time. Let me quote him. He says, local radio is critical. So we emphasize to people that they should keep a portable battery-powered radio in their disaster supply kits and in their go bags. Obvious, but it needs to be said every time. Have your radio handy, right? He also said that as things move along in the days ahead, broadcasters will inevitably shift into the role of helping communities recover. He said, in fact, something quite telling, I guess, the national media will go home. But the local stations, those broadcasters, they live here. It's a community. And we've seen this time and time again. For the local stations, it's still big news helping their community with the longer-term recovery. So, yes, local radio, the men and women of the hour.
We say that all along. We privately say ourselves we're the smallest NPR station in the nation, but at every transmitter site we have installed generators. And we did that at considerable expense here at the radio station at all our transmitter sites. And David, to point out how important it was years ago when we had That major power outage, which affected the entire state of Connecticut for about 12 hours out of power, we were the only radio station that operated around the clock because all of our transmitter sites had backup power. We didn't miss a beat over the whole statewide blackout. And that's how important local radio is in just giving people the comfort to know they can find out moment to moment what's going on.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, it really shows that of all the media available, radio stands the best chance of being the most valuable to the communities themselves. I mean, the rest of us can look in from outside on using television and the like, but when you're in the thick of it, what seems to work most usefully of all is locally based radio, and having a backup generator makes the best sense of all. Do we have the fanfare this week?
I have the fanfare ready to go right now.
That sounds good. It could be applied to local radio in general, and especially for the hardworking people of Florida's radio stations, and it's well-deserved. I had it in mind already, though, because I want to celebrate a different aspect of local radio. I want to fanfare some good, basic, workmanlike journalism that's emanated from this branch of the media that you and I, Marshall, might value most of all. We both have something of an inclination for it, don't we? You make your full-time living out of it. And it's not just a valuable medium in extreme natural disaster times. And my point is that my hometown public station is WNYC, and we should dedicate this fanfare to one of its dogged reporters this week, Matt Katz. Matt works the criminal justice beat for the station, which, of course, this being journalism that we're talking about, more often than not, that means criminal injustice. This week, Matt Katz has got his hands on some material that would be gold dust for any journalist. He's made something of a specialty over time, of highlighting problems at New York's Rikers Island. You'll know it, of course, the city's prison island, a dismal section of the city skyline of high-rises that you can see from nearby bridges when you drive over them. And this week, thanks to Matt Katz invoking the Freedom of Information Law, FOIA, Katz has given an official report with some gruesome pictures of actual conditions inside the prison confines. It's from the Board of Correction. That's the authority whose job is to oversee the city's Department of Correction, who actually run this jail complex and all the other jails in New York City. And when I say gruesome, I mean images of, for instance, a man locked in a shower cage for nearly 24 hours until he ended up injuring himself. Incarcerated people having to rush injured or sick individuals to get medical help with no officers around, and the incarcerated people themselves having, in some cases, to administer chest compressions to people who passed out, with, again, no staff to be seen. Oh, and can't get past this, human feces are just about everywhere to be seen in these pictures, sometimes not cleaned up for many, many hours or even days. Plus lots of insanitary and physically dangerous conditions in the fabric of the buildings itself. The provenance of these pictures is interesting in the journalistic sense. The city's relatively new district attorney, Alvin Bragg, wanted to impress on his team of hundreds of prosecutors just what it means when they argue in court for pre-trial custody for accused people, when they push for no bail or requesting bail to be set at some unaffordable level. Because we need to remember that most of the people, and you know, most of the men and women held at Rikers Island are there pre-trial. They have not been convicted of crimes, and they're simply awaiting hearings of their cases. Some have lived at Rikers for years. Reporter Katz pointed out that both the population and the average length of stay in city jails have increased dramatically in recent times. He cited figures from the mayor's office saying that nearly 30% of the incarcerated population in the city has been in pre-trial custody for more than a year. So District Attorney Bragg had the board make this presentation to his prosecutors for a reason. It's best dramatized maybe in the words of a former inmate that Katz interviewed called Five Mullah Mark. Mr. Mullah Mark said, prosecutors never see Rikers. They never see where they're sending people to die. And that's not the rhetorical hyperbole you might hope that it would be. Katz has also been repeatedly reporting over recent months about the increasing number of deaths at the jail complex. As September's ending now, the rate of death so far this year is already outpacing last year's deaths. But Katz and his colleagues at WNYC and their accompanying city news website, Gothamist, it's a very useful partner to have when you're a radio station and you want to show photographs, they all clearly felt that this presentation should be seen not just by public prosecutors wanting to put people in jail, but by the general public themselves, who, after all, pay for those jails. Good journalistic work. I want to commend it.
You know, and when we talk about Rikers Island, people watch shows, like, and I'm not criticizing the shows because they're entertainment. They watch the shows Real Crime. They watch the shows that are on a weekly basis and Law and Order. And they see all the time pictures of prosecutors and assistant DAs going out to Rikers Island. It doesn't happen. And, you know, when you allow it...
Not that much. No, not as much as you'd think.
No.
Guided by drama. No. Yeah.
Go on. You know, what's interesting about it is that if you're going to have a jail system, okay, and we need jails, there's no doubt about it, but how dangerous does the jail system become when you allow it to fall to those conditions, not only for the inmates that are there, but for the people that are working at that particular jail, what it does to their attitudes, how they treat people, and it's all one big cycle that really can end up with the story that you're talking about being broken.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've been into Rikers a few times. I can't say that I've made a dedicated study of it. Far from it. Katz really does deserve commendation for his application and dedication to this particular story. But constant reporting and treating it like a beat, like I say, the criminal justice beat, really pays off, and there's an authority to that kind of reporting, which is well earned. And in this case, it might lead to some change, some improvement in the administration of Rikers, which I think everyone concerned with the problem now recognizes is in need of radical overhaul. Rikers is out of sight, out of mind for most of the population, and therefore this kind of total abuse of public provision, because that's what it is. It's something that is there to serve the public, to protect it, and to, you know, do the fundamental job of a prison service, as well as keeping people confined. It's also meant, you know, it's to sound like an idealistic bit of whistling at the moon these days sometimes, but it's there to assist in the reintegration, ultimately, of prisoners into the population as a whole. And we shouldn't, forget the basic and perhaps mercenary consideration that the public's paying for this. We need to know how well or otherwise an institution is doing its job. And clearly there's a lot wrong with Rikers Island. It's a good thing for journalism to point out exactly what is wrong and how wrong it is.
All right. I want to switch here for a second and go to the war in Ukraine. There was an article written by a guy by the name of Gabor Steingart, and it was released today. I got a it was in German, but I got a translation for it. It's titled "Putin's Actual War Target Is Not Ukraine, but Germany." And what the article goes on to point out is that he's got his problems with all of Western Europe, and the strongest power right now, he sees it, is Germany. So this is a more of a big broad based plan. And you know, I mention this simply because of now all the wild rumors and stories about who's responsible for the two gas lines being blown up. And this situation now, as in my opinion, I mentioned this to Jill Goodman and a few other people, that this is, if actually Russia, in my opinion, did the sabotage of those lines, that is almost, could be declared an act of war if proven against NATO. And it's obvious that this writer has got a great article mentioning that really you take down Germany and you bring Germany to its knees, and hopefully, according to Putin's plan, the rest of Europe will follow.
Yeah, it's a geopolitical story as well as an on-the-ground reporting kind of story. And those wider considerations need to be fully aired in a thoroughgoing way. As you say, it's not yet possible to say definitively how those instances of sabotage in the two Nord Stream underwater pipelines came about. Clearly explosions of a kind. They were recorded seismically in Sweden, a seismic measure, and yeah, it's an extraordinary thought that it might be Russia which inflicts physical and economic damage on itself by blowing up its own pipelines, but it's perfectly feasible, and we know that extraordinary things go on under the command of Putin. Extraordinary in a negative sense, as well as you know, just the sense of the scale of what gets done. But this war has the widest of ramifications. We've talked, you and I, about the world food supply being affected so seriously by it. And yes, the standoff, because that's what it is, between NATO and those countries that stand with NATO or want, like Ukraine has come to over time, and even more so now, of course, wants to be a member of NATO. NATO on the one side and Russia under Putin on the other. It's a standoff, and Russia, as you say, is the leading and most powerful and the economically richest member of NATO in Europe. We've got it playing out very, very clearly in front of us. Everything needs to be thoroughly aired as we consider the choices between various evils. What is the lesser of the range of evils available to the West at the moment for dealing with Russia? Interestingly enough, again, I turn to a hometown source, the New York Times. It's also a little like the fanfare bit of journalism we were talking about just now. The New York Times has been in receipt of certain material, which is from an official source, also like the prison documents and photographs that I was talking about just now. But in this case, it's audio recordings given to the New York Times by Ukraine military sources, military intelligence sources, It's something that goes on in every war, and it's an interesting piece of journalism, which operates on the ground, but illustrates one of those wider points that you were wanting to bring up. You know, the old New York Times slogan, all the news that's fit to print. Well, in this case, it's a piece of spying by the Ukrainians, and what they spied on was Russian soldiers who disobeyed orders, soldiers always do, when they were ordered not to use their cell phones, Russian soldiers on the ground. But in lots of ways, they probably disobeyed orders. But in this case, they made calls home on their cell phones to wives, families, girlfriends, and the like. And the Ukrainians were listening in. And the Times spent a couple of months verifying and translating the calls. And it published them this week as a special feature. Being ordinary soldiers, in this case mainly Ukrainian, the Russian National Guard and some airborne units, they're of course, as inevitably soldiers always are when they don't think that they're being overheard, they're critical of their commanders, including their commander-in-chief, as a result, these are kind of, well, journalistically, priceless pieces of material evidence, if you like. The calls may not be, they may be fit to print in the New York Times and in that New York Times phrase, but they're not credible verbatim on our public radio network, I'm afraid. But they are emphatic and revealing. And actually, there's one I can quote from it. It's not as vulgar and obscene as some of the comments. One caller home says, Putin is a fool. He wants to take Kyiv, but there's no way we can take Kyiv. So overall, the fighters calling home were complaining about strategic blunders. Guess what? Yes, strategic blunders by the Russians. And very tellingly, a dire shortage of supplies. And they confessed also to capturing and killing non-combatant civilians. And they openly admit during these calls to looting Ukrainian homes and businesses. Many of them say they want to terminate their military contracts as soon as they possibly can. And constantly, they completely contradict the official propaganda that's issued back home in describing what they see as the stark realities of the war that they're a bit part of. The very revealing of the truth on the ground, you know, the sort of insights that you can sometimes get even in the midst of the fog of war.
I want to switch away from this and give you a little chance to talk about some reporting you did for PBS, and that is the spike in deaths at the southern border.
Oh, sure, yes. NPR reported yesterday that deaths at the southern border have reached a point now. The numbers weren't available immediately for NPR to quote, but they were given, again, it's a piece of official, excuse me, official leaking, if you like, of numbers. But the Border Patrol sources told it, please excuse me, just a second. Thank goodness for the mute button on live broadcasting. the frog in my throat is gone. Yes, the Border Patrol provided NPR with numbers, which they couldn't verify and didn't broadcast as actual numbers, but they were confident enough to say that the deaths of people crossing the border, people who die in the process of crossing the border, is higher now than it's been ever before, unprecedented. And This is in line with some reporting I did some years ago now. It's 2015 when I filed this report. It was essentially about deaths then. The NPR report currently concentrated on many people drowning in the Rio Grande and the Rio Bravo, if you're coming from the south, is what it's known on the southern side. But also there's the Sonora Desert in Arizona, where I filmed, which is an unforgiving desert in which many people get lost. People are driven more and more to cross in remote, inaccessible parts of the borderline, and they end up dying of exposure. It gets really cold at night, and some of the bodies that I filmed were men. Almost always it's single men who die on their own, wearing layers and layers of clothing. I reported from the morgue of Pima County, which extraordinarily, outside of the two major metropolitan jurisdictions of New York City and Los Angeles, Pima County, on the border between Mexico and Arizona, has the most overcrowded morgue in the nation. It's an extraordinary thing to report. But this is going on again, day after day after day, and yet it's yet another indicator. It's one of the many markers, if you like, of a totally, totally broken immigration system. It's good to see NPR continuing to report on this and finding angles that demonstrate so clearly the broken nature of the system. And if anything, it seems to be more broken than what I reported on it just those few short years ago.
It's a situation that everybody knows the immigration system is broken. It's just a question, how do you fix it? And it shouldn't take 20 years to fix. There's far more important things that need to be worked on that are being worked on. Just imagine how far ahead of the curve you were, David.
Well, I don't know. It felt like being in the midst of it right then.
Yeah.
There's an extraordinary organization called Colibri, which is the Spanish word for hummingbird. The hummingbird represents in lots of Central American cultures a kind of messenger between the living and the dead. And Colibri's mission is to—it's kind of gruesome, but rather touchingly kind in its nature. Its job is to reunite bodies with the families of the people who die in these extreme conditions, and it's very difficult because, of course, in the nature of things, the individuals who do die are not carrying any identification. So then it becomes a real challenge to forensic scientists in Pima County. The medical examiner in Pima County is doing an extraordinary job finding out who these people are and who might be their families. And then just occasionally, a body is returned to a family, and there can be a proper, usually a Roman Catholic, funeral service for the dead individual. It's valiant work, and that too needs to be recognized, I think.
All right, David, always great to talk to you. We'll check with you again next Friday on what's going on with the Media Beat.
I look forward to it. See you then.
David Terechuk with the Media Beat. Once again, you can find his website at themediabeat.us, and you can also find our reports at robinhoodradio.com. Click on demand, click on the Media Beat with David Terechuk.